5. We're going to reset the parenting series by going back to our text, or at least the outline of the series is going through the fruit of the Spirit that we read about here in verse 22 of Galatians 5. And so let's read here from this passage again. Appreciate all of you being here, singing out. Appreciate Taylor leading us in The Battle Belongs to the Lord, one of my all-time favorite songs. Galatians 5 and verse 16, "But I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. For the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit, and the desires of the Spirit are against the flesh. For these are opposed to each other to keep you from doing the things you want to do. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. Now the works of the flesh are evident: sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, envy, drunkenness, orgies, and things like these. I warn you, as I warned you before, that those who do such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things there is no law. And those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. If we live by the Spirit, let us also keep in step with the Spirit. Let us not become conceited, provoking one another, envying one another." So we've taken the title of this series, No Greater Joy, from 3 John, verse 3, where John says, "I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth." The highest joy that we can have as parents is to see our children become like Christ. It's the greatest dream we can have for them. And we're talking about how to shape young hearts. Children come into this world completely innocent. They're a blank slate. And no one will have more influence on a child's life than his or her parents. And even when they become children, or when they become teenagers and young adults, there's no one that has more influence, even at that age, than a parent. We continue to be the dominant influence in their life. And this is a great responsibility that we feel. But we're calling this shaping young hearts through proactive parenting. And what do I mean by that? Well, acting in a proactive way is the very opposite of acting in a reactive way. It's acting by principles and values rather than just emotional reactions. The fruit of the Spirit, that's the end goal. That's what we want for our children. And the fruit of the Spirit is contrasted with the works of the flesh. That's what we want to do. That's what comes natural to us. It's not natural to be full of love and joy and peace and patience and kindness. That's not natural. What's natural is for us to be engaged in rivalries and dissensions and strife and jealousy and fits of anger. That's what the flesh wants us to do. And this is a war going on in our minds every single day. As Paul says, the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit. The desires of the Spirit are against the flesh. They're opposed to each other. And it's a war and it's a conflict that our children feel. And it's our job as parents to proactively not only teach these things to our children, but to also model them. And so we're going to talk tonight about patience. And talk about one of the hardest things for a parent to deal with, both in terms of teaching patience and modeling patience. I used to think I was a patient person before I had kids. But as Ryan pointed out so well this morning, God is faithful. God is there with us in the foxhole as we're fighting these battles day by day, not just fighting with our kids, but fighting within ourselves, the desire to be impatient, to lose our control. And a lot of the things that I'm going to talk to you about here in just a moment come from a book well, here are the fruit of the Spirit, the characteristics we're seeking to develop. And this idea of being proactive, that comes from a book I've referenced so far. A lot of the series has been based on a lot of the principles taught in The Seven Habits by Stephen Covey. And his whole book began, this whole series of books that he wrote on The Seven Habits, began with him in a library discovering this quote right here. Between stimulus and response, there is space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom. And he defines four unique human gifts that we all have. Gifts, blessings from God. Self-awareness is the first one. This is the ability to stand back from yourself and objectively evaluate your behaviors and thoughts. We have that ability as humans to look at ourselves objectively. Conscience, which is the inner voice that tells you whether something is right or wrong. Imagination, which is the ability to choose and to think of a principled response. Rather than what we naturally want to do, what we feel, the flesh feels like doing, we can think of a better response that's based on our values rather than just our emotions. And then fourthly, independent will, and that's the power of choice. The ability to act on those principles. Or as our daily readers read recently in Deuteronomy 30 and verse 19, Moses says, I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore, choose life. That is a blessing from God. We don't have to choose to follow the flesh. We have the freedom, the independence to choose what is right. And in the story of Cain and Abel, we see all of these four human gifts at work. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. There's the flesh. That's the natural response. He got angry. And he started thinking about some things that would be wrong and sinful. This is the reactive impulse we see in Cain. But God sees that, and he comes to Cain, and he asks him a question. And this question is calling on Cain to use the first gift that Covey talks about, and that is self-awareness. The Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? What's this all about? I'm not sure Cain even understood why he was angry. He knew he was angry at his brother, but is it really all about his brother? Or is it about God? Why are you angry, Cain? He's calling on Cain to think about his emotions and his reactions based on those emotions. And he calls on him to use his imagination to think of a principled, better response. Why are you angry and why is your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? Think about this, Cain. I know what you're thinking about doing. I know what you want to do, but isn't there a better way? That's what God is calling on Cain to do. And then he calls on Cain to exercise his free will. If you do not do well, God says, sin is crouching at the door like a lion, ready to pounce on him and devour him. That's the flesh. Its desire is contrary to you, but you must rule over it. You don't have to do what your anger is leading you to do right now. You can choose a different course of action. And then finally we see, after Cain kills his brother, God calls on his conscience. It says, Cain spoke to Abel, his brother, and when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel, your brother? Now God is asking a question he already knows the answer to. We see God do that in the garden with Adam and Eve after they sinned. And here in Genesis 4, he does the same thing with Cain. He knows what happened, but yet he's asking the question because he wants Cain to ask himself, where is my brother? He said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? And the Lord said, what have you done? So we see in this story, and this is a story about family conflict. It's interesting, the first murder we read about in the Bible is brother on brother. It's in the family. And so this is about our families. That's where a lot of the conflict that we deal with day to day comes from, is the things that happen in our own homes. And it's a teaching opportunity for us to look at Cain and ask ourselves, why am I angry? It's an opportunity for us to exercise our conscience and our independent will and our imagination to think of a better, more principled response. God has given us these gifts and is calling on us to use them in the proper way. Covey goes on and talks about the circle of concern versus the circle of influence. These are concentric circles. The circle of concern is the larger one you can see here on the screen that includes everything in your life that you're concerned about. And of course, that includes your kids. We're all concerned about our kids. But the circle of influence is smaller than the circle of concern. The circle of concern, everything that we're concerned about, extends well beyond what we can actually control or influence. And the reason Covey likes this analogy is because when we focus on the circle of concern, the things that we can't control, what happens is our circle of influence diminishes. Whereas if we focus on what we can control, the circle of influence, then it grows. There's a lot of scriptures that illustrate this point. Nagging does not work. Nagging is where we are focused solely on our circle of concern. And the Proverbs 21 and verse 9, it is better to live in a corner of the housetop than in a house shared with a quarrelsome wife. Solomon probably had a few that he just wished he could find some corner in his palace to get away from. It didn't work. It didn't work. And it doesn't work with children either. A continual dripping on a rainy day and a quarrelsome wife are alike, Proverbs 27 and verse 15. And this is not just advice or wisdom for wives and mothers. It also applies to husbands and fathers. Husbands, Colossians 3 and verse 19, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. And part of the reason why he's telling them not to be harsh with them is because it doesn't work. You can use your authority in that way, but it doesn't work. That's your circle of concern. Circle of influence is love, showing love and demonstrating love. That is a much more effective way of leading and influencing your wife and your children. And he says this to fathers as well. Same thing, two verses later, Colossians 3 and verse 21. Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged. And of course, this includes, there are a lot of different ways that you can provoke your children. But one way is when, instead of focusing on what we can actually control, what we can actually influence, we use coercive ways with our children and we cause them to become discouraged. We provoke them to wrath. An example of someone who exercised his circle of influence, I think, is the father of the prodigal. He said, there was a man, this is Luke 15 and verse 11, there was a man who had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me. Now, where was the father's circle of concern? Did the father know what would happen if he just said, okay, here you go? Well, of course he did. The father was wise enough. And especially, you know, why was the younger, and we don't have the backstory, we can only assume, but why was the younger wanting his share of his inheritance? It's probably because he didn't like the rules at home. I'm sure that there were several conversations that did not end well before this conversation. The father knew where this was going. He knew where this was heading. But what did he also understand? I can't control my son. And so what the father did is he gave his son the freedom to make his own choices. He says, you want your inheritance? Here, have it. And what happened, happened. But in the meantime, as the father is sitting there waiting, wondering, praying for his son as he's gone, the father is imagining, what am I going to do if my son comes home? How am I going to respond? That's what he's praying for. That's what he's hoping for. And there are a lot of fleshly responses that he could have had. There are a lot of things that the flesh was telling him, well, when this son figures out what life is like, not under my rules, not under my authority, having his freedom, I'm sure he had a lot of sermons prepared in his mind of what he was going to tell his son and explain to him, I told you so. But that's not what he did. The son came home, and what did the father do? He first ran and met him, and then he said to his servants, bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and so on. This is a father who is acting with wisdom. He is focusing on his circle of influence rather than his circle of concern. And by the way, he also uses this influence with the other brother, the older brother, the good son, who, when the younger brother comes home, goes out and sulks and is mad and is angry, not really at the younger brother, but angry at his father. It seems like his whole beef with this whole thing is not that the younger brother came home, but that the father receives him. And yet, his father came out and entreated him. This is a wise father. And this is the kind of thing that we need to think about as parents, is how am I going to respond in the moment? Am I going to allow the flesh to just an emotional outburst in the midst of some crisis or concern? Or am I going to act in a more principled way? What does this look like? One way to respond is like this. I can't believe the way these kids are behaving. They're driving me crazy. That's one way you can respond. Or I can create rules for the family to help my children learn about consequences for their behavior. I can seek opportunities to teach and reinforce positive behavior. Which one is of the flesh and which one is of the spirit? Which one is reacting in a negative way and which one of these is a positive, proactive response? There's a difference. Nobody helps around here. It's always take, 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 and I give, give, give. And nobody thanks me. Or we can share responsibilities around the house by setting up a fair division of daily chores. I'll reward service with words of affirmation and praise. Which one of these is going to be the better response? Which one of these is going to influence the children more? My son constantly complains about how much stress he's under. He thinks his life is hard. Try being a parent with adult responsibilities. Or I need to talk with my son about the source of his stress. Maybe there are some ways to simplify his schedule. Or at least we can think of strategies to cope with life better. Do you see the difference? And which one of these is modeling patience? Which one of these is modeling the fruit of the Spirit to our kids? We need to think in principled ways and not just react when our kids are not meeting our expectations. Let's talk about patience. Have you heard of the marshmallow experiment? It was a study on delayed gratification by a professor of psychology at Stanford in 1972. In this study, a child was offered a choice between a small but immediate reward or two small rewards after a period of time. During this time, the researcher left the room for about 15 minutes and returned, and they were offered either a pretzel or a marshmallow based on their preference. And if you've seen the video of some of these kids, they still do this experiment today, It is priceless watching that kid just looking at that marshmallow. Promised, hey, if you'll wait, you'll get two marshmallows, but if you eat the one, that's all you get. And it is priceless. But what they have found in follow-up studies is the kids who are able to wait 15 minutes, and that's a long time for a little kid to be staring at a marshmallow. The kids who have the ability to delay gratification long term are much more successful in life. They've followed up these kids when they become adults and when they take SAT scores, educational attainment, body mass index. They've taken several measurable things, and the kids that at a very early age were able to delay gratification were much more successful in these measurable ways. But beyond the measurements these researchers are looking at, there are significant spiritual outcomes that we would include. How much value does the Bible place on the idea of us learning patience? It's a lot. Galatians 6 and verse 9 says, "Let us not grow weary of doing good, for in due season we will reap if we do not lose heart, if we do not give up." The gospel is not about immediate gratification and immediate reward. It's about delaying that, waiting for something better, far better. Romans 8 and verse 25, "But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience." Our hope is not based on what we can see on the plate in front of us. It's about what we can't see, what has been promised to us, as Ryan talked about this morning, from our faithful God. That's why patience is important to us as Christians. And patience not only influences our relationship with God, it influences our relationships with our brothers and sisters in Christ. Ephesians 4 and verse 2, "With all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love." That's a discipline that we must have if we want to be a part of the family of God. Proverbs 15 and verse 18 says, "A hot-tempered man stirs up strife, but he who is slow to anger quiets contention." Patience is critical to every relationship we have, beyond just our relationship with God and our brothers and sisters. This is going to influence the way our kids interact with their peers, with their classmates, with their coworkers someday, their employers someday, with every relationship that they have. It will influence the way that they act and react in their own marriages and with their own children if they're blessed with those relationships someday. How important is it that we teach our children to wait, to have patience, to not have that immediate gratification for every whim, every desire that they have. James 1 and verse 19, "Know this, my beloved brothers, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger or wrath." And so what can you and I as parents do to develop this quality in our children? How can we teach our children patience? How can we teach them this valuable ability to delay gratification, to wait? Well, the answer is discipline. But not discipline in the sense of just corporal punishment. Discipline in the sense of training. Look over Deuteronomy chapter 8. Deuteronomy chapter 8. For those of you that were in the wilderness study, this will be very familiar to you because this is where Moses, speaking to the second generation of Israelites who came out of Egypt, looks back to the wilderness and explains, this is the reason why God caused you to be out here wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. This was not unintentional. It was very purposeful, everything that God did for you and your children. God did this to train you. Deuteronomy 8 and verse 1, "The whole commandment that I command you today, you shall be careful to do, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land that the Lord swore to give to your fathers. And you shall remember the whole way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you and let you hunger and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Your clothing did not wear out on you, and your foot did not swell these 40 years. Know then in your heart that as a man disciplines his son, the Lord your God disciplines you. Notice all the things that he said God was teaching them and training in them. He was humbling them. How did the wilderness humble them? Well, it taught them humility because they were helpless. They were like children depending on their father to provide daily bread. They knew where their bread came from. And that wasn't necessarily going to be the case in the promised land. And that's what Moses is concerned about here in Deuteronomy 8. Is you're going to come into this land, houses you didn't build, vineyards you didn't plant, wells you didn't dig, and you're going to vainly think in your heart, look at what I have done. My power and my hand have gained me all this wealth. And you're going to forget the Lord your God. Well, they couldn't forget in the wilderness. Every single day, God was humbling them, teaching them with that manna where their bread came from. God was testing them. How did the wilderness test them? It was actually the opposite of the marshmallow test. Instead of being given one treat and told to wait for two, they were given unlimited manna, all they could carry. And yet they were only to get enough for one day. That was the test. It was exercising their self-control, their patience, their willingness to trust that if I get just enough for today, all this manna will be back out here tomorrow. And I'm going to trust in God. The most shocking part of all of this is that God let you hunger. What father would do that to his children? Are you kidding me? He let his children go hungry. They were crying. They had no food. A loving father does that. God did that to his children, and it was for a very specific purpose. And that purpose, as he explains, was to discipline them, to teach them that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. This is the kind of discipline a loving father gives. We don't learn patience when we have all we want, whenever we want it. Patience can only be learned through hunger, through need, through lack. Patience can only be developed by waiting. And waiting is not fun, especially when you're 4 years old. Waiting is hard. But patience can only be found in the wilderness of life. And of course, we're not living in a wilderness now. In spite of the fact that gas prices are high, most of our choices have not changed all that much. Most of the day-to-day decisions we've been making and what we do and where we go and all of that, our children haven't felt the effect, and honestly, neither have we. If our children are going to learn patience, we're going to have to be very intentional about it. So I'm going to suggest a couple of things that you can do with your children as we think about application. I want to talk about mealtime and church first. I think I mentioned this in one of the previous lessons, that Adrian and I listened to several hours worth of tapes before Anna and Josh were born. We were getting ready, new parents, soon to be parents, I should say. And we listened to this couple, a man and his wife, talk about how to manage with little babies and toddlers. And one of the things that they talked about was the importance of mealtime and the importance of bedtime. And Adrienne took this to heart. I called her the sleep Nazi. Because when it was time to take a nap, you took a nap. And when it was time to go to bed, you went to bed. And it didn't matter how much you cried and how much you complained, that's where you were going to be. No gratification, no reward for pitching a fit in bed. That may not be your thing, and that's fine. But I do think that there need to be opportunities where our children learn to wait, where they learn that the world does not revolve around them. Mealtime is a great opportunity for that. For us, it was sit on your bottom until all your food is eaten. And that was the rule. And that's not easy for a child. And it's especially not easy. Now, it's a little easier when they're strapped in, you know, to the high chair. It's a little harder when they have the ability to get out, right? But that's what God did. How did God teach his children patience? Mealtime. Every single day, God used meals to train and to discipline his children. You get just enough for one day, and that's it. And there are consequences if you take more than that. God was teaching and training through meals. Church is another great place to teach patience. Church is not the most engaging place for little ones. Let's just be honest about that. Having to sit still for an hour plus is a chore. It's a chore for adults, much less children. And I understand the attraction behind attended nurseries and children's church, but let me say something about that. I don't think parents realize what they're missing. When we were singing "The Battle Belongs to the Lord," could you hear the little voices? When we sang "Magnify, Oh Magnify" this morning, that was music that I know pleases God, but it means something to all of us. And you as parents, when you hear your children singing along, that is a blessing that we have that you don't get with attended nurseries and you don't get with children's church. But one of the things that I noticed in one of our daily readings recently was in Deuteronomy 29, when the covenant was renewed there in Moab, Moses, it says, summoned all Israel to come together. And he mentioned all the groups that came together, and I'm just going to read them to you. The heads of your tribes, your elders, your officers, the men of Israel, your wives, those who draw water, those who chop wood, and your little ones. The little ones were invited to the worship service or the covenant ceremony, which I'm sure was not all that engaging for the little ones. But they needed to be there. They needed to see and to hear what would happen there. But think of what children are missing when they are not given the opportunity to be in an environment like this. I've been to funerals before, and the funerals that I do, I don't typically do long messages, but I've seen families that don't normally go to church and their kids are not used to sitting still for even 15 minutes, and they really struggle to make it through. And I'm thinking, they're missing so many opportunities to learn just basic patience, how to sit still for even 15 minutes. We need to understand that our children, I'm becoming an old crotchety guy on some things, and I need to understand, I remember what it was like. Well, let me quickly say, Adrienne was the one, you know, when I was preaching every Sunday morning and evening at Vernon. She was the one wrestling with the twins and dealing with all that. It's not easy. I understand that. And there's nothing wrong with having distractions for the little ones. But there comes a point in time where our children need to learn to engage, and not just in the singing. One of the reasons why I started printing out these outlines was when Anna and Josh got old enough that they could pay attention and not just play. I was like, whenever you see something underlined or in yellow up on the screen, I want you to write that down. Now, Joshua's first outline, he was into dinosaurs and dragons, and that's what he would write in, you know, his notebook and everything. I remember the title of my sermon, I asked the kids for the outline back to see what they had done. I remember the title, there were horns coming out of the title. But he filled in all the blanks. But this is an opportunity for our kids to learn patience. Just simple things like learning to sit still for a lengthy time is an opportunity to teach patience. The other suggestion I want to give is to create entertainment Sabbaths. It's understandable that screens are an easy way to pass the time when children are bored. We took some really long car trips when the kids were young, and we had this contraption where we took this, it was a tube TV that we strapped in. It had a VCR tape player underneath it, and we were able to strap that in between our seats. We weren't rich enough to have one of those drop-down screens in the van, and so we strapped that in, and the kids would watch videos on these long trips. And I understand that screens can be helpful in that way. But I don't think it's good for kids to constantly be looking at a screen, especially little ones. And I'm not a doctor, I can't speak with authority on this, but there is research out there about especially young children and screens. It's not good for them. The attention span of children is getting smaller. It's becoming more and more of a problem, I think, because of screens. That's my unscientific, undoctor opinion. But for all kids, we need to have times where there are no screens. And I would say even on the long car trips, there are opportunities that we're missing. Deuteronomy chapter 6, when are we to be talking about the law with our children? Well, one of the things that he mentions is when you lie down, when you rise up, when you walk by the way. Think about all those long, boring trips. Jesus walking with his parents to Jerusalem for the Passover feast. And what are they talking about with their parents? Well, they had to talk about something, right? Those moments of boredom, those moments where there's nothing going on, are great family times. And beside just the family time that we have, again, it teaches and reinforces patience. And so I don't mean to be an old crotchety guy, you know, saying we shouldn't have screens. But we do need to have breaks, and we need to have limits. And you decide what that is. I think every family has to decide for themselves. But that's my suggestion to you. And let me come back to the first point I made, and that is that the best way we can teach patience is to model it. I remember Sewell preaching a lesson on fathers do not provoke your children to wrath. And he put up on the screen about 20 different ways that a father can provoke his children to wrath. And I told Sewell, I'd had a bad week that week. And I told him after the lesson, he said, I feel like I've violated at least half of all of your things just this in the last 7 days. And I remember Sewell telling me, just keep loving them. Just keep loving them. And that stuck with me. Jesus showed frustration. You remember when he came down from the mountain, the Mount of Transfiguration, and the disciples and the crowd are arguing about something, and Jesus comes up, and it was this man who had brought his son, who was afflicted with this unclean spirit, this demon. And his disciples were unable to cast it out. And Jesus just announces to everyone, oh, faithless generation, how long must I bear with you? Moms and dads, we all can relate, right? Jesus felt frustration. But then the very next thing he said is, bring the boy to me. In spite of the way Jesus' flesh felt, and he was tempted in all points as we are, in spite of the way he felt, he did the right thing. And that's what will define us. As parents, are we just going to continue to do the right thing in spite of how we feel? Our children are watching. They can see when we're frustrated. But when they see us respond in our frustration, in our time of weakness, in the right way, we are teaching them such valuable lessons about how they should respond. And I'm the chief of sinners. Okay, so just keep, like Sewell said, just keep loving them. Just keep coming back and doing the right thing with them. We serve a loving God. I wish I had put a slide up on the screen showing all the scriptures that talk about God's patience with us. And aren't we thankful for that? As many times as we mess up. God isn't going to give up on you if you don't give up on yourselves. Each week, I've been going with George back there to the prison over in Phoenix City. They have a tremendous work going there. Had 14 baptisms yesterday. Praise God. But George is in there talking with these guys. And George and I, we can't relate to what these guys have been through their life. But George is telling them, hey, God still loves you. God hasn't given up on you. And maybe that's the way you feel. Trust me, God still loves you. That's the reason why you're still living and breathing today. God's grace has given you this moment, given you this opportunity to do what's right. And so if you're ready to make that next step and confess Christ, be baptized, or if you're ready to come back, if we can help you in some way to do the right thing, why don't you come as we together stand and sing.